Welcome, and thank you for standing by. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants will be in a listen-only mode for the duration of the call. During the question-and-answer session, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. I would now like to turn the call over to Jeff Rosenfeld from the American Meteorological Society. You may begin.
Thank you. And thank you all for attending. Welcome to this annual briefing on the state of the climate. My name is Jeff Rosenfeld, as you know, and I am the editor-in-chief of the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. And before I get started here, an important reminder, today's press briefing follows a slide presentation that you can download. So the link, in case you need it, if you or don't have the email right in front of you, you can go to www.ametsoc.org. That's ametsoc.org/climate. And the full report is also being released today, so you could follow that first link for the slides, and the full report is downloadable at ametsoc.org/SOTC. AMS is proud to be publishing the State of the Climate 2017 as a peer-reviewed supplement to the Bulletin, our flagship scientific journal. And this is the 28th edition of the State of the Climate. And it's actually our 23rd year of publishing it with NOAA there as part of the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. The report is the result of a huge international effort, as you will learn. It's led by our country's very own National Centers for Environmental Information, which is part of NOAA. And you'll also hear something very important, I think a good way to think about this report. It is basically like an annual physical, like a doctor's checkup for our planet, for the Earth's climate system. And as you know, from checkup to checkup, Earth, like our bodies, is changing, and in important ways. We want to know what's happening, of course. As patients, we expect our doctor to monitor all of the important processes in our bodies. And the State of the Climate report does that kind of work for Earth itself. This is a checkup that carefully and precisely measures important baselines. This means checking the same thing year in, year out, with great consistency. The State of the Climate is a testament to that kind of perseverance and dedication on the part of the scientists who author this report. It is science at its most consistent and steady over the years. Now, climate science means establishing those norms by monitoring the same thing over and over as carefully and precisely as possible. Those baselines help us detect change and figure out what's normal and what's not over the long run, even though we might not feel great one day or might feel great the next day. Just as our bodies are changing every day, it's changing over the long run, and the planet is doing the same. We're living that kind of volatility every day with weather, and we need to find ways to cut through that variation and figure out what's going on, where the trends are. Now, the climate science community relies on longevity and careful repetition in a way, but it also relies on the latest and greatest. That's how this report is what it is. It's become, over the years, a much, much bigger and more sophisticated report. It is basically the most sophisticated and detailed and thorough assessment the climate community can provide on an annual basis. It's a huge effort to do that. But this doesn't mean the checkup is exactly the same every year. It grows, it gets more complex, just because the climate system, like our bodies, is very complex with lots of moving parts that are interacting. But we see the result of that interaction every day, and we see it in the hurricanes, wildfires, record heat and cold that 2017 brought to us. But beneath that are some important trends, which you're going to find out about today, and I think are the important part of this story that needs to be told every year, just as that story is told at the doctor's office every year. Now, science, of course, is about the latest and greatest in the frontiers of knowledge, and it's changing. And just like doctors, we use the latest tools and observing equipment and the most advanced tests and procedures, whatever is necessary to get the job done to the best of our capabilities. And that is part of the reason why not only is this report growing, but it is why AMS is involved in it. We are conducting peer review with over 100 additional scientists beyond the over 500 who are authors of the report. This is a huge international effort, and the reason for that is because you'll find in this report it's referring to new techniques and new ways of doing a better job of that year-in, year-out checkup. And there are references to papers that are just out now, basically, that are the bedrock of this report. So the science is changing. The science is evolving, getting better all the time. The checkup is getting better all the time. And that requires a pretty substantial peer review effort to make sure that it's done as well as possible. And that's what this report is. It represents a peer-reviewed statement about the climate, and it's pretty much the best that this large international community of scientists can do. So I want to give a shout-out to our other panelists who are the people who actually did this incredible work, putting it together yet again for this 28th year. You'll first hear from Deek Arndt, who is a scientist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, and he'll be followed by Greg Johnson, one of the chapter editors, and then Emily Osborne, another one of the chapter editors. So, Deek, why don't you take it away from there?
Thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you for joining the call, everybody. I'm going to start on slide number 3 with some of the content from the report. And Jeff has already covered much of this. I just want to emphasize that this is a report with international origins, with an authorship truly spanning the world. The map that we have on here, each country with a color on it has contributed at least one author, and then each country with colored in orange has also contributed an editor. And the chapter editors like Dr. Johnson and Dr. Osborne that are going to follow really do provide a great deal of the subject matter expertise, and they reach broadly across their disciplines and help bring together experts from diverse pieces just within their disciplines. Very appreciative to work with folks like that. So jumping into the content of the report, slide number 4, titled La Niña. We mentioned in the bullet the state of ENSO, and ENSO is the El Niño Southern Oscillation, and this is an important influencer of outcomes on the season-to-season and region-to-region and year-to-year basis. So it's surprising to me every year, having been involved with this report for a while, just how broadly El Niño and La Niña are mentioned throughout the report. And so we typically lead with a reminder of the state of ENSO, which was in weak La Niña conditions at the end of the year, and then according to some metrics, flirting with weak La Niña conditions as we entered 2017. But it was largely what we term an ENSO-neutral year, finishing in a weak La Niña. This is one of the immediate influencers of some of the more detailed content that we'll talk about in coming minutes. So this is an influence on kind of the season-to-season and year-to-year scale. You'll probably hear all three of us mention it at one time or another during this presentation. Slide 5 shows a more longer-term influence. So if La Niña and ENSO neutral conditions were a more immediate influence, then a longer influence on some of the trends that we see in the decade-over-decade kind of time scales are long-lived greenhouse gases. And we see each of the three major long-lived greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, were the highest that we've recorded them in the instrumental era. These are important because they trap additional heat in the climate system raises temperatures at the surface and causes other changes associated with global warming. The graph here shows the contribution of each, not so much as a concentration, but as its but each gas's relative role in the additional heating due to the trapping of energy by these greenhouse gases. The largest is carbon dioxide, followed by methane, then nitrous oxide. Carbon dioxide, pound for pound, is not as potent as the other two gases, but it is the dominant greenhouse gas now because there's a lot more of it in the atmosphere. It's measured in parts per million rather than parts per billion, and it's a very long-lived of the long-lived greenhouse gases. So there's a lot of it that lasts a long time, and that's why it is the gas most associated with the warming. The next slide, slide number six, one of the kind of bulk parameters that we measure. We'll dive into details on the regional and seasonal basis. But the globally average surface temperature, that is the temperature measured near the surface of the Earth, whether that's over land or the ocean, was either by most data sets, the third warmest on record, by one data set, the second warmest on record, and these records typically date to the late 19th century. It was about 0.38 to 0.48 Celsius warmer than a recent 30-year average that we use here in the U.S., called it the normal. So compared to that average, about a little less than half a degree Celsius warmer than that average. Again, this is the temperature average throughout the planet's surface. It was the warmest year on record that was not influenced by an El Nino. One of the roles of El Nino is it does tend to push the needle on global temperatures to bring them up slightly above trend. So in spite of the lack of influence of El Nino, it was the third or second warmest year on record. It was easily the warmest non-El Nino year on record. And the last 4 years, 14, 15, 16, and 17, are the four warmest years on record. And the last 3 years are kind of far and away, or at least substantially warmer than the previous, kind of establishing a new neighborhood in terms of global temperature. And 2017 reinforced that. Slide seven shows trends in humidity over time. Like all of the graphs in this presentation, on the left are our past conditions building towards the current conditions on the right. The top two rows on this slide show what we call absolute humidity, or just the measurement of the total amount of water vapor in the lower part of the atmosphere. And one well-known tenet of meteorological science is a warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor. We would expect in a warming world that we have higher water vapor values, higher absolute humidity values, and that's exactly what we're seeing. This year was yet another year that reestablished the trend that we've seen in recent decades, that the total amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is increasing. And on the next slide, slide eight, one of the consequences of that, at least partially, is a warmer atmosphere can carry more water vapor, and an atmosphere that carries more water vapor can deliver more precipitation when storms and rain-producing events happen. And this year, I think, jumped out even a little more than in past years I've been involved this. Heavy precipitation was a pretty pervasive theme throughout most of the chapters. So we experienced rainfall associated with hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria that were quite large. The damage that we experienced in Harvey was associated with rainfall that was as much as two times the value of previous records over the five-day period that we saw in Harvey. So kind of a pervasive theme throughout the report. There were, in any year, there is significant flooding in places, but Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane or Tropical Cyclone Debbie in Australia and New Zealand both delivered very large quantities of precipitation, again, consistent with expectations in a warming world. And then tropical cyclones overall, globally averaged, it was a relatively near normal year for tropical cyclones, which we call hurricanes and tropical storms here in the United States. When we look kind of ocean basin by ocean basin, we see that the North Atlantic was a very active year, and the other basins, the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, were either near or below their typical activity, and that's both in the numbers of tropical storms and hurricanes that were observed and in the total amount of energy, how strong those storms were and how long they lasted. The North Atlantic was very active in those senses, and the other basins were relatively inactive or near normal. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Greg Johnson, who will talk about the ocean system.
So on slide 10, you will see two curves on the bottom. One goes from 1950 to 2017. The second, a little longer, goes from 1880 to 2017. There are three different analyses on that. We will focus on the ERSST analysis, and this is global sea surface temperature. It was warm in 2017, slightly cooler by about 400ths of a degree relative to the 2016 record high. But the difference between 2015 and 16, and in fact between 2016 and 2017, is within the yearly confidence limits of about 600ths of a degree C, and that's that gray shading that you see around the white line in both plots. That small drop is probably related, though, to a tropical Pacific cooling. After the 2015-2016 El Nino, we transitioned into a weak La Nina, and that tends to drop sea surface temperatures a little bit. But that drop is on top of a long-term warming trend. If we look at the warming trend, say, since the turn of the century for ERSST version 5, it is about 1,700ths of a degree C per decade. If we go to slide 11, we look in the report below the subsurface of the ocean as well. And what the two plots on the right show are global ocean heat content. From 1993 through 2017, in a couple different layers. The top plot shows it from 0 to 700 meters in the ocean. This is historically the best sampled part of the ocean, and there are six different groups from around the world that contribute analyses. They all do it, their quality control slightly differently, their mapping slightly differently, but they all agree that 2017 was a record high relative to the historical record. I should tell you what the vertical axis is on this plot. This is in zettajoules. A zettajoule is a joule with 21 zeros after it, so it's a huge number. And the ocean from 1993 to 2017, the ocean, just the upper 700 meters of the ocean, took up about 150 zettajoules of energy. That is a massive amount of heat. It's the oceans are really the heat sink for the climate system. You'll also notice in the plot that there's very close agreement among the estimates. Since about 2005, the wiggles tend to come together, and that's because we have a remarkable Argo array of robotic floats that achieve global coverage around 2005, sampling the upper 2 kilometers of the ocean, actually. And this is one of the reasons why our diagnosis gets better and better. We can see that heat content going up because of this robotic fleet. The bottom panel, you see from 700 to 2,000 meters, there are four groups that provide analyses for that layer, and that's also steadily warming, again, with good agreement since around 2005, 2006. Also in that bottom panel, you'll see a blue wedge that only goes through 2010. That's the 2,000 to 6,000 meter ocean warming trend. Argo floats don't reach that deep yet. But ships do, but they only visit the global oceans about once a decade, so we have that slight delay in our diagnosis there. But if you assume that warming from 2,000 to 6,000 meters is continuing through 2017, the full depth warming trend from 1993 to 2017 is about 350 terawatts, and that could be anywhere from 300 to 400 terawatts. But 350 terawatts, again, a terawatt is a watt with 12 zeros after it. That's around 18 times humankind's global energy consumption rate for 2017. So it is indeed a massive amount of heat. Now, as the ocean warms, it expands. We're now going to go to slide 12, and we'll look at sea level. So ocean expansion is one component of sea level. The total sea level is measured in the black curve here on the right, and that, again, goes from about 1993 to 2017. This is measured very accurately by satellite. And you can see that the global sea level in 2017 was about 3 inches higher than it was in 1993. And in fact, the trend is about 1.2 inches or 3.1 centimeters per decade over that time interval. What I think is really interesting, though, is that we can measure sea level a couple of different ways. So Argo gives us the expansion of seawater because it warms, and that's that red curve at the bottom of the plot. And then we can also actually measure the ocean mass by a pair of satellites that measure fluctuations in the Earth's gravity, and that's the blue curve. and we put those two, the red and the blue together, and we get the purple curve. That purple curve is the sum of the two components of sea level rise. The mass changes are due to glacial and ice sheet melt, and the heating obviously is the red one. And the purple curve is completely independent from the black curve, but they show the same pattern. So to summarize, the first three slides that I've talked about, surface fluctuates, ocean warms more steadily, seas continue rise. You'll find that in that little haiku in the report if you look carefully. I'd like to urge you to actually look carefully at the report. And one of the things that on slide 13, I'm just going to draw your attention to is a couple of sidebars. They're short, 1,000 words and a figure or two each. And they talk about some of the impacts of the very warm sea surface temperatures that we've seen. So one is entitled Unprecedented 3 Years of Global Coral Reef Breaching, 2014 to 2017. And the bottom left figure shows the places where alert to coral reefs are susceptible to bleaching from extreme heat between 2014 and May 2017. It is quite... I find it quite stunning, actually, the extent to which this record warm temperatures affects an important part of ocean ecosystems. And then on the right-hand panel, we also have a case study entitled Nuakai, Flooding in Hawaii Caused by a Stack of Oceanographic Processes. You'll see the red curve shows the water height above mean low water level in Honolulu Harbor at a tide gauge, and August 2017 had a record sunny day flooding event. Nuakai means piled water in Hawaiian, and it refers to the stack of oceanographic processes that cause that. The long-term warming and melting that leads to sea level rise in the green curve on the bottom, some ocean eddies that actually modulate that and bring heat to around Hawaii in August, and then a relatively high astronomical tide as well. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Emily Smith. Emily Osborne.
Hi, Greg. Thanks so much. And this year, I got to serve as one of the editors for the Arctic chapter for the BAM State of the Climate Report. It was my first year serving as an editor with colleagues Jackie Richter-Mengi and Martin Jeffries. And I'm really excited to share some of the many highlights, but just talking about a few here today. So in turning your attention to slide 14, Arctic sea ice is an important barrier between ocean and atmospheric circulation and limits the amount of incoming solar energy that's absorbed by the ocean. It's also an important habitat for life below, within, and on top of the ice, and until recently has vastly restricted the ship traffic in the region. And so on the left-hand panel here, I'm showing a figure of both the minimum and maximum extents recorded in 2017. So sea ice coverage does vary significantly seasonally between winter and summertime. So in March, which is the panel shown on the left, the post-winter maximum or Arctic sea ice extent can be 2 to 3 times greater than what's observed in the summer or September period when it's at its minimum. So in March of 2017, the winter sea ice maximum extent was the lowest ever observed during the satellite record. And the satellite record for the Arctic spans from 1981 to today. Estimates of total ice volume in the Arctic measured by a number of ice moored instruments also indicated a decline in the thickness as well as the age of the ice. And so the age of the ice is important because this older or multi-year ice is more resistant to summertime melt, and the thicker ice also acts as a better insulator between ocean and atmospheric exchange of heat. And so as we're losing this thicker multi-year Arctic sea ice and we're seeing it being replaced by younger or less than year-old ice, there's this greater fraction of ice up in the Arctic that's more vulnerable and prone to melting in the summertime. So I'm turning to the right-hand figure and the left panel showing the September 2017 extent. What we saw was that 2017 wasn't necessarily a record-breaking year. It ranked 8th lowest in the observational satellite record. It did cover 25% less area than the long-term average, which we look at between the years of 1981 and 2010. But something that I do want to highlight is that in the last 11 years, we've had 10 of the lowest September minimum extents recorded, and that does include the minimum observed in 2017. And so in understanding the magnitude and pace of this change that we're observing today, it's really important for us to look further back into time. And so turning your attention to the right-hand panel, what I'm showing here is a compilation of paleoclimate records from all around the Arctic. And what these paleoclimate records show is that both the magnitude and the sustained rate of sea ice loss that we've observed in the last couple of decades in the Arctic is unprecedented in at least the last 1,450 years. And so that time constraint is put there because this compilation of records spans that period of time. That's not to say that this unprecedented decline can't be extended further back in time, but just for now, the records we have are just really spanning this interval. And so in moving on to slide number 15, looking at the Arctic Ocean, we see that summertime surface ocean temperatures in 2017 were particularly high around the Arctic in the marginal seas. Temperatures in the Beaufort and Chukchi seas, which bordered the Alaskan Arctic, were 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, or roughly 5 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than the long-term average over the last two decades. This longer exposure period of dark, ice-free ocean to sunshine caused extreme ocean heat to build up in the Pacific Arctic, particularly in the Bering and Chukchi Seas, and this excess heat contributed to a very late fall freeze-up, or when ice extends from the North Pole down and covers the Pacific Arctic sector. So freeze-up was an entire month later than usual in this Pacific Arctic sector in 2017. And moving on to slide 16 and thinking about Arctic land, both thawing permafrost and an increasing wildfire frequency pose considerable threats to the well-being and livelihood of Arctic residents. On land in the Arctic, permafrost temperatures have continued to rise since the 1980s, and many observatories across the Arctic broke temperature records this past year. Specifically in Alaska, 5 of the 6 long-term permafrost observatories recorded all-time high temperatures. These warm permafrost conditions correlate with both anomalously warm atmospheric temperatures across the Arctic. There's also an increase in the depth of soil that actively freezes and thaws seasonally, meaning that the Arctic landscape is literally becoming more unstable. This instability compromises infrastructure, including homes and roads, that depend on the stable frozen permafrost. Warming atmospheric conditions, extended snow-free periods, and overall decreases in precipitation in the Arctic also coincide with a longer and more extreme wildfire season in the Arctic. In Alaska in 2017, the Upper Yukon Zone, which is in the northeastern and central portion of the state of Alaska, endured a particularly intense fire season. It accounted for more than half of the total acreage burned across the state of Alaska. While the fire activity in 2017 was not as severe as that observed in 2015, and in fact was quite average, it did demonstrate that changing weather patterns can leave some regions particularly vulnerable to these massive and devastating burn events, like the Yukon Zone in 2017. Something else that I would like to draw your attention to is that the Arctic chapter of the 2017 BAMB report does include a section on Indigenous knowledge holders, as these two topics discussed here on this slide pose significant threats to the people that live in the Arctic environment. So this sidebar, which is contributed by Indigenous scholars, actually talks about the holistic view that these scholars have of the environment and the long-term perspective that they have on change, and really encourages both scientists and Indigenous scholars to work together to produce a more holistic view of the changing Arctic system. And moving on to our final slide, 17, atmospheric temperatures in the Arctic continue to warm at twice the rate of the lower latitudes, a phenomenon that's been widely referred to as Arctic amplification. 2017 was, in fact, the second warmest year on record following 2016 and was recorded at 1.6 degrees Celsius, or nearly 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the long-term average spanning from 1981 to 2010. This amplification of warming is due in part to the loss of these reflective white surfaces in the form of snow and ice, which used to reflect much of the incoming solar radiation and are causing the environment to warm. Warmer atmospheric conditions have led to a breakdown of typical atmospheric circulation set up by the gradient between the cold Arctic air masses and the warmer mid-latitude air masses. Where these air masses meet, the jet stream forms, and this influences weather patterns across the lower 48 and globe, as you can see in the right-hand panel. The illustration in the lower right shows a scenario or an actual event in December of 2017 when there is a breakdown of the normal temperature gradient and what was normally a well-formed jet stream now wobbles significantly, as you can see in this December event. So this is sometimes termed as the Arctic blast weather events, depicted in this illustration where we see this cold Arctic air spilling over into the north and southern eastern U.S. While Alaska is actually experiencing unusual warmth, which again occurred in 2017 in December. And with that, I will turn it over to Jeff and we can get started with questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily, Greg, and Deke. Thanks for your presentations. And yes, we will want to get right to the questions. I just want to emphasize a couple things that were mentioned here. One is, don't be afraid. It's a 300-page report. No one expects you to read it all at once. And actually, the researchers who use this as a reference see it that way, too. It's kind of a slow burn for them. They use it when they need it, and they use it often for various checkpoints and research needs. And you can look at it the same way. There are tons of stories in here. Those sidebars that were mentioned are very short, good leads to some interesting stories around the world about how climate is affecting us, how we make these observations, and what kinds of questions are still out there. And so there are lots of other types of stories that are buried in here. I think any country that's had 4 years in a row of record-setting temperatures has got to be feeling the squeeze right now, and Mexico has had exactly that. 4 years in a row, they've set a new record. You'll find in here that, we have a streak of 38 consecutive years of glaciers shrinking across the globe. I mean, that's Joe DiMaggio in the making, right? So there are a lot of stories, and we're looking forward to your questions. So let's go on to that.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first and last name clearly when prompted, as well as your organization. Once more, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first, last name, and your organization clearly when prompted. Our first question comes from Seth Borenstein from the Associated Press. Your line is open. Apologize if I said your name incorrectly.
No, actually you did it correctly, which is rare. Thank you. I have two, one for Emily and one for Greg. Emily, so you do have the two big different measurements with Arctic sea ice, winter max and the summer min. In terms of for the overall health, is there one more important? I mean, you once again broke that winter max. Is that one more important than the summer min? And then for Greg, if you don't mind just explaining why we should care about how much heat is in the ocean, especially in the upper ocean.
Hi, Seth. So this is Emily in response to your question about the sea ice minimum and maxima. I wouldn't say that one is more important than the other. I would say in the last decade that in the Arctic, we've seen a lot of the records being broken in the summertime with this minimum ice extent just shrinking further and further back. And so this year, it really did pop out to us that we're seeing those records being broken after the winter growth period, so in March when we had this low extent. And I think the implications can be a little bit different between those record-breaking years. So what we saw in 2017 was that in association with this year where we had this record low extent, we also, in the Pacific Arctic, like I was talking about on the next slide, saw this really record late freeze up because you had this longer exposure period where sunlight is coming in and building up heat in the upper ocean and really changing the dynamic in the region. So at least in the wintertime, when you're expecting ice to be in a place where it's not, it can be really disturbing to these communities and really the whole ecosystem of timing of migrations and things of that. So I think there are different implications for the minimums and or maximum records. I wouldn't say one's more important than the other, but we're definitely seeing this maximum record having some different interesting impacts.
Thank you. And Greg, how would you explain to average people why we should care about the heat content in the upper ocean?
So this is Greg Johnson. I would say there are multiple reasons why we should care about the heat content in the ocean in general. First of all, the ocean is taking up about 93% of the excess heat that's entering the planet due to the increase of greenhouse gases. And it's a remarkable amount of heat. As the ocean takes that heat up, it expands, and that leads to sea level rise, which has an impact on coastal communities. Also, as the ocean warms, it affects ocean ecosystems like the coral reefs, the coral reef bleaching that is highlighted in the sidebar. You see fish change their ranges and moving. We had a sidebar last year the year before on changes in the East Coast fisheries and how they are migrating as the oceans warm. The other thing is that I sort of think of the oceans like a freight train, where we've started to push them with greenhouse gases, and that freight train is now moving, and actually it will continue to move. So if we were to freeze greenhouse gases at the level they are today, the oceans would continue to warm and seas continue to rise for centuries to millennia because of the majestic timescale of the ocean circulation. Let's see. And the third thing is actually different changes in ocean heat content with depth. The surface warming more than the deep ocean also leads to changes in how nutrients can get up to the surface. It increases actually the density difference between the surface ocean and the deep ocean, and that tends to decrease oxygen below the light surface layers and decrease the amount of nutrients actually that can get up to the surface layers. And both of those are important for ocean ecosystems.
And is it fair to say that if the oceans are carrying more heat, that eventually some of that heat then comes back out of the oceans too, to the atmosphere? Or is that still not?
I wouldn't say that. What I would say is that the oceans are sort of they provide the slow time scale for the climate system. So the what is again true is that if we stopped the greenhouse gases at their current concentrations today, actually the atmosphere would still continue to warm a little bit for the next couple decades to maybe a century, and that's because again it takes even the surface oceans a while to warm up. They really are kind of like a flywheel of the climate system because of their enormous capacity to absorb energy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Willie Dry from National Geographic. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. I just had a couple of questions that came to mind as we head into the peak of this year's summer hurricane season. You mentioned some possible implications that might be caused by warmer sea surface temperatures and so forth. Slide 17 in your presentation mentions effects on the jet stream, and I'm wondering if this could have any effect, any immediate or long-term effect on steering currents that would affect a hurricane's track, and anything else that you might think relevant during your answer about how it could affect storms this season and in the future.
Hi there, this is Deke from NCEI, and I'll take a shot at that. This report does not necessarily concern itself with attribution, so how one piece of the climate system or one event may be related to larger scale changes. I will say that the influence of particularly the retreat of sea ice and snow cover and the relationship of that with jet stream behavior is an active area of research. There is an emerging body of research that is looking into a possible connection there. That's a little beyond the scope of this report, but if you'd like, we can get you in touch with some leading researchers that are looking into that phenomenon.
Yeah, if you could. Could I get that after the presentation, or how would I obtain that?
Absolutely. The media contacts associated with this report can get you in touch with them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kim Miller from Palm Beach Post. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having this. I'm here in South Florida, and I don't know if you've been watching the news that's been in the Wall Street Journal, but we're dealing with serious outbreaks of red tide, blue-green algae, and having terrible fish kills and manatee deaths over on the West Coast. A lot of it has to do with increased precipitation. We had record rainfall in May, and I'm wondering if there's anything in this report that I could pull out and say, you know, here's something we saw in 2017 that might be contributing to the horrible impact that that's happening right now.
Hi, this is Deke. Thank you. There are sections, regional sections, so the North American section of the regional climates chapter will provide an overview of the big events that affected the U.S., Canada, and Mexico.
Okay.
You can, in particular, that section does speak to some large rainfall events. Again, we're not a document that seeks attribution of specific episodes, but you may be able to glean some background, both from that North American section and then in the global chapter, chapter two, there's a sidebar on how we handle, treat, analyze, and kind of document extremes in precipitation, and that may be relevant to your research as well.
Okay.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, record your first, last name, and organization clearly when prompted. One moment as we wait for any additional questions.
Last call for questions.
Do not show any additional questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. I guess that will conclude our briefing, and the State of the Climate 2017 is online. It's also going to be in print with the August issue of the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. I want to thank Greg and Emily and Deke for their participation. Also, a shout out to the other lead editors who couldn't be here. But I want to emphasize that this report will be a good resource over the long haul. And good luck with your stories, and please contact us if you have any other questions. Thank you again.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.